Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, don't I know you from somewhere? I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
And today we wanted to talk about the speed of communication and how that might one day be a problem. Now, if you listened to our previous podcast, you probably heard us talk about how we've really kind of cracked the speed nut as far as communication goes here on Earth. It's more of a throughput or bandwidth issue than a speed issue. But when you start looking beyond Earth, we still have that speed problem, don't we?
Mm-hmm. Well, across long enough distances, yeah.
Yeah, and we have a fairly recent example of how this can become a challenge with the landing of the Curiosity rover on Mars that happened in 2012.
Right. I remember the night this happened.
So do I. I remember I was covering it live for This Week in Tech.
Yeah, I was just blogging about it on Facebook, basically.
Awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was watching the live stream, which is interesting because there were two delays going on. There was the delay between what was happening on Mars and the people at the...
For whom it was actually important.
Yeah, at the NASA JPL mm-hmm. finding out about it. And then right. the delay, of course, between them and then me at my house getting the stream.
Right.
But when you think about that, it's interesting because those are two totally different scales of delay.
Yes.
One is a very small delay based on throughput. Like, how long does it take the bits of data from their transmission to get to my computer so I can watch them as pixels on my screen?
Right.
And that's throughput, like we talked about last
time.
It's
squeezing. It's a few seconds.
Yeah, it's nothing. It's just trying to squeeze that data into the wire fast enough and get it to my house.
Reconstitute it on the other end. Yeah.
But the other one has a really serious, significant physical limit.
Yes.
And what is that limit? Well, it's the speed of light in a vacuum.
Right.
Which is very fast, but...
Oh, it's quite fast. It's like 186,000 miles per second,
yeah,
basically.
And we think of it as the universal speed limit, although more on that later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we can say that now, right? That's a good thing to start with, actually.
Yeah.
Einstein's theory of relativity says that essentially nothing with mass can go the speed of light or faster.
Right.
It's an absolute limit, and the reasons for that are multiple, but
basically
it
would take infinite energy, mm-hmm. and by the time that you worked up to it, you would have infinite mass, and
right,
everything
exactly.
would be messy. Yeah.
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 Yeah, that's exactly it. It would be impossible to propel yourself because you'd anyway, yeah, good way to put that. So we think that's the universal speed limit.
Right. That's what resulted in the fact that it took us several minutes to learn the fate
right.
of
that's
the Curiosity rover.
Yeah, that's what I was getting to. So we're here on Earth, and the people at the people of the Jet Propulsion Lab didn't know for about 14 minutes whether the lander had succeeded or whether it was,
crashed into a fiery,
like Martians had captured it and taken it for their sick purposes.
Their robot wars.
Right. or what? We just had no idea. And so here it was just an issue of suspense.
Right.
Because the transmission traveling at the speed of light at the maximum speed takes that long to get to us, and we just don't know. But this could actually be a real problem for exploring other planets, right?
Oh, yeah.
What if you needed to control something in real time on another planet?
The Mars landing was relatively simple. I mean, we were pretty sure that we weren't crashing it into any mountains, and mm-hmm. we were pretty sure there were no giant space slugs out there ready to eat it. So it was okay, but,
Yeah, but if there had been space slugs.
Yeah.
Or if the planet's surface had been treacherous enough where for some reason we thought a human being would be more capable of piloting that ship rather than a very sophisticated computer, then obviously that would have been an issue because mm-hmm. there would have been a very long delay from the time when the lander would be able to relay that information to you, and then just as long for your commands to go back to the lander so that it could adjust in any way. And by that time, conditions will have changed dramatically. I mean, you're talking half an hour almost.
Right. Mm-hmm. So this is a weird case where it's not really a problem here on Earth, but when you start exploring the galaxy, the speed of light just isn't fast enough.
So we need something faster.
We do. is there a way to talk to the Curiosity lander faster than light can get from one place to another?
Well, before I give my answer, I think we should probably talk about some potential ways that it
according
and then I'll give my answer at the end.
Right.
According to Star Trek, there are these there's this subspace that's kind of like a parallel dimension that these these particles called tetrions are floating around in. And these are really really random momentum particles, and when they bleed over into real space, all kinds of wacky stuff happens that makes for really compelling television, hopefully.
Right.
But as far as I can tell, this is not one of those things. It's really a plot device more so
than any
kind of physics.
It's a how do we get around this fundamental problem? Let's explain it away with something that doesn't really exist.
Tetrion particles, oh no!
And then we just say, oh, they were discovered in 2272. So that way, no one can complain about the fact that these things don't seem to exist.
Well, the Vulcans have been using them since Earth year 1950.
Yeah, the Vulcans are the universe's hipsters. We have established that. You know, they were using tetrion particles before it was cool.
They even have the little hipster bangs like me. That's great.
They, however, have already moved beyond the ironic mustache.
Yes.
Yes.
Clearly.
Joe?
You know, it's funny that the difference essentially between science fiction and fantasy is that the magic things in fantasy are designed to sound like religious items, and the magic things in sci-fi are designed to sound like things from a science textbook.
Well, and of course,
and tetrion is really close to...
They could be called, like, obelisks of, you know, like, it's just...
Shards.
It's a magic thing either way.
Yeah, but tetrions is a really close word to tachyons.
Yeah.
Ah, there we go. Well, so some people do think that maybe tachyons could help us talk faster than light, get information from one place to another at superliminal speeds.
Sure.
So
what is a tachyon?
Well, a tachyon is...
Hypothetically.
I want to emphasize this, a hypothetical particle.
Right.
That means, and that's different from a theoretical particle. Theoretical would be one that's integral, like, to some theory that
Higgs boson,
right?
Sure,
integral to some theory that we have good evidence for.
Right,
hypothetical just means like we can posit it and we can sort of talk about it, but there's no evidence for it.
You can justify it in the sense of creating a mathematical expression that where it makes sense, but there's no other evidence whatsoever for
it. And even the first thing you said, the making sense mathematically is questionable here,
but
we can talk about that in a second. So tachyons are superliminal particles, and that means that they always go faster than the speed of
they
light.
They cannot approach the speed of light. They cannot slow down that much because it would take, again, an infinite amount of energy to slow them down.
So you sort of imagine a big X shape.
Uh-huh.
And we and all the matter that we know about are in the bottom triangle of that X.
All right.
Right? We live down there, and as we and the where the X's where the triangles intersect, basically, the cross of the X, that's the speed of light.
All right. Sure. So it's the center of the X.
Right. And as we approach that, going up toward the top of our little triangle, things start getting wonky, of course. You know, we have time dilation and crazy stuff, and we can't get to the apex of that triangle.
Gotcha.
They live in the top triangle. Tachyons are up there, and they're basically an inverse of everything that we experience in the bottom half. As they approach the speed of light going down towards that cross, things get wonky. It stops making sense.
Okay.
But they travel faster than light. If they exist, it's possible, some people think, that, well, could we harness them to communicate faster than light? And there are some serious objections, I think, to this hypothesis. One of them, of course, is, as we said, we have no proof that these things even exist. So we're talking hypothetically anyway.
Sure.
And that should always be noted as a major objection.
Right.
But number two, you would bring on causality paradoxes if you could really use what some physicists described this device as the tachyonic anti-telephone. Right. It's a device that allows you to call the past.
Right. So, so essentially right, because, what happens is the person who receives your message would get it before you had actually sent it.
Right. And that's actually what Einstein's theory of relativity says, right? If you go faster than the speed of light, what it seems to imply is that you would start going backward in time, which doesn't make any sense at all.
Right. At least as far as we can understand.
Right.
Right. And so that's another major objection. Also from what I've read, if you look at tachyons, the math is really strange to justify them. So again, using relativistic equations, what it looks like is that in order for a tachyon to have actual real energy, it has to have imaginary mass.
Right. I remember seeing an example being it would have a mass of the square root of negative 1.
That's exactly right.
That's an imaginary
number. An imaginary number,
that just,
right.
That hurt my brain.
Well, yeah, I'll tell you what's hurting my brain. So Joe was talking about this X where all of R matter's on the bottom.
Okay.
And all the tachyon stuff's right on the top. Who lives on the left and right?
I think that was the neutrinos from the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles cartoon series.
Okay. All right. Well,
and the street sharks, they're over on the right.
I'm back up to speed now.
Okay.
But I've been lost since then.
So, relativistic street sharks carry our data faster than light, and then we've done it. Basically, the tachyon business is really complex and definitely above my head. But from everything I've read, people who know what they're talking about don't seem to give this much credibility. They don't think you can do it. One major problem is, again, you mentioned the two different parts of the X.
Yeah.
Well, they're two different parts of the X.
Yeah.
So even if these things exist up there, there's no way to know that we can mess with them.
Yeah, there may be no way to interact with that at all.
They could be what physicists would call free particles, meaning that they just don't interact with our type of matter.
Right. Well, I have another little hypothetical thing. This one's very goofy.
Yeah.
All right. So let's say that, Lauren, that you are in a you're living in a space station.
Like I do. Yeah.
You know what? You're building robots to eventually take over the planet around which your space station orbits.
I've asked you not to talk about this in public.
I'm sorry.
Which planet?
It'd be for this argument's sake, we'll say Earth.
Okay.
This is all
a certain ringed planet that I will not name.
This is all documented in the movie The Terminators. And then let's say that I'm on a space station that's 500 light years away.
Good.
Okay.
And so thanks, Joe.
No, that's not what I meant.
I think this show's going to have one less host and one fewer host in a minute. So let's say that I want to get Lauren's attention, but I'm 500 light years away. If I were to send a message from our respective points of view, that would take 500 years at light speed to go from my station to her station. And in 500 years, Lauren might not care so much that I found her old cell phone that she left in the space station.
That Facebook status update would not be critical anymore.
Right. So let's say that I've devised an ingenious plan. I have a bell installed in Lauren's space station, and attached to that bell is a string that's 500 light years long. And the end of that string is inside my space station. And so I just grab the end of that string and I give it a really good tug so that it'll ring the bell inside Lauren's space station. Now, wouldn't that bell ring the instant I pull that string? Thus, I am able to communicate. I'm able to get some form of information across instantaneously across 500 light years without having to send a message all the way through.
No, and that would actually be way, way slower than a normal... Yeah.
Than light speed? Because we're talking about sound speed?
Right. Yeah. A radio transmission travels at the speed of light. A wave propagation along a string travels at the speed of sound.
Right. Yeah, you're talking about the same thing.
Well, I mean, might even be slower than the speed of sound.
Well, it's essentially the speed of sound.
It's the speed of string.
Speed of sound, well, speed of push or speed of pull.
Right.
Is the way a lot of people say it. But it's the speed of sound through that particular medium.
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, like if we were to change that and instead of it being a string, it's a pole. So it's like a metal pole that stretches 500 light years, and I start to move my end of the metal pole, it would actually take longer than 500 years for that to propagate across the entire length of the pole so that the end that's in Lauren's space station would start to wiggle. This seems counterintuitive, but it's completely true. It's dependent completely upon that vibration propagating across, that wave propagating across. And you can see this. There's some great videos on YouTube where people have a slinky. and they're holding one end of the slinky up vertically, like, you know, so that the bottom of the slinky is off the ground. And then they let go of the top of the slinky, and then you watch it in slow motion. You can actually watch the wave propagate across the length of the slinky. Now, the top of the slinky starts falling toward the ground according to gravity, pulling it down. It's accelerating at the speed of gravity. But the bottom of the slinky remains in place until that wave propagates across it.
That's pretty cool.
That's
so,
really
cool. You'll actually see, like, the top of the slinky is falling to the ground, and the bottom of the slinky is still
hovering
there,
yeah, mm-hmm,
until that wave propagates, and then the bottom of the slinky starts to fall.
Wow.
So this is – now, on Earth, this is so quick that we mm-hmm barely notice it, right?
Yeah,
you
negligible
would need an incredibly long – slinky for us to notice this when it's not slowed down to super slow speeds. But when you're talking about light years, that's a huge distance, and at that scale, this stuff really matters. And so that's why you could not just have, you know, two cans and a piece of string and just chat across the emptiness of space that way.
Yeah,
and expect
okay
an answer anytime soon anyway.
So we've established that tachyons probably a no-go. Treehouse telephone not as good as what NASA uses.
I tried really hard though.
So what else is left? Are there other ways people think we might be able to go faster than what we've got?
Well, here's another theoretical sort of, well, hypothetical sort of thing, but it falls apart once you do the math. I don't have a whole lot of detail on it, but I just want to kind of give a quick shout out to the Casimir effect, which is a small but measurable force that exists between two uncharged conducting plates when they are incredibly close together. And photons that travel across the gap between these two uncharged conducting plates go faster than the speed of light by a very, very, very small amount.
What?
Yeah. So based upon measurements, the photons are actually moving faster than what photons can move. However, and this is all theory, by the way,
right,
but theoretical investigations into this effect to see if this would be a way to scale this in any form of communication have turned out to show that there's nothing there. You can't communicate this way.
Mm.
Then there's quantum entanglement.
Quantum entanglement.
Yes, speaking of photons.
Yeah, the photons are one thing you could do. You could do with polarization of photons. But quantum entanglement, this is the idea that...
Before we get into this, we should say that this is the big one, right?
Yeah.
This is the big kahuna. This is the one that people think, they really do think, maybe,
right,
maybe
there,
we
there's
can
this
do
one,
it.
This one and quantum tunneling. Those
right
are the
yeah
two
yeah
big ones.
Yeah, they're actually talking about setting up a quantum entanglement experiment on the International Space Station.
Yeah.
So let's get into it.
So yeah.
So quantum entanglement brings in some problems with quantum theory. Well, I say problems. Einstein said problems. Einstein found this idea of quantum entanglement to be really problematic
spooky
and scary. Spooky, yeah. He actually called it spooky action at a distance.
Well, what is that action, Jonathan?
So quantum entanglement is this concept where you get these two subatomic particles, and they are entangled in such a way that the behavior of one will tell you something about the behavior of the other.
So necessarily? Like you definitely know?
When they're entangled, yeah. Well, wow. Not definitely. Because it gets a little complicated.
Because
Heisenberg's uncertainty principle tells us that we cannot know
everything about
a particle.
Any particle. Right.
We can draw a conclusion about something about the other particle's behavior.
Right.
So, for example, we might talk about the spin of a subatomic particle.
Mm-hmm.
Now, spin can be across different axes.
Sure.
It's not just across one axis. But for the purposes of this, I'm just going to say we're just going to look at one axis of spin to make this a simple example. But please keep in mind that this is just a simplified example. It's not how the physical world works.
To work. Yeah.
Right. So let's say that you've got two subatomic particles that are entangled, and one of them is spinning along an axis in a clockwise direction relative to your position.
Okay.
So when you observe it, it looks like it's moving in a clockwise position. Remember, everything's relative. Well, then the other particle, even though you haven't even looked at it, you will know that because these two are entangled, the other particle is going to spin in the opposite direction of the first one. So it's spinning in a counterclockwise mm-hmm or Wittershins direction based upon your perspective. Read your Shakespeare,
relative.
Joe.
Yeah.
So it's clockwise and counterclockwise, or as one of my directions once said for a fan that I was trying to build, anti-counterclockwise would be the first one, and clockwise would be Whatever. So yeah, one's turning clockwise, the other one's turning counterclockwise. By observing one, you know what the other one's doing. But right. at that point, that entanglement breaks down. They are no, the behavior of one is no longer dependent or entangled with the behavior of the other. They're not dependent.
Because you observed it.
Right, because you've observed it. That system has broken down. That's one of the big challenges, or really the big barrier to quantum entanglement, is that you cannot actually pass information through entanglement.
Well, wait a minute. I don't know if we said for sure why this would be faster than the speed of light, and that would be because you can take these things really far apart.
Right. You could take one subatomic particle to the other end of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in theory, anyway.
And once you've entangled them, they're
entangled. Right. It's non-localized. It's the locality is not an issue. At least, well, locality as we understand it in the sense of space.
Mm-hmm.
In the quantum world, locality means lots of different stuff. So it's one of those things where part of the problem is just the vocabulary and the way that the quantum physicists use it as opposed to people like me.
It could be that these two quanta are actually right next to each other in a dimension that we can't even see. Right?
That's one way of looking at it, yes.
Yeah.
So in the dimension of space, they could be very far apart. You could have one on the other side of Alpha Centauri and one here on Earth. And by observing the one here on Earth, you know what the one on Alpha Centauri – what that one behavior of the one in Alpha Centauri was doing.
So that's positing the transfer of information instantaneously, or another thing I read was that they think maybe it goes at like 10,000 times the speed of light or something.
Yeah, that's what one professor has come up with recently.
The Einstein, Boris Podolsky, and Nathan Rosen all thought that this was a terrible idea, and that it was clearly that the problem was that we just didn't understand enough about quantum theory and that this could not be possible. They raised
but
what was called
now the, we know.
well, now we do know different things,
We do know
we
more,
do,
but I don't
well,
do
we
know
enough.
Sorry.
We know it's impossible for a different reason.
Yeah.
For a different reason than what they came up with what was called the EPR paradox, which is essentially what I was saying, that you know, you cannot transmit information faster than the speed of light. And in fact, I saw a great example. Karen Masters at Cornell has a little webpage where she was answering questions about this sort of stuff. And she said, all right, now imagine this scenario. You've got two friends and they are an equal distance away from you on the other side of the galaxy. So one's in one direction, one's in the other direction. And before they left, you told them that you would send a beam of light to each of them. And the beam for one of them would be red, and the beam for the other one would be blue. And you would send them both at the exact same time. So you send those beams, and the one on one end of the galaxy sees red. So they know that the one on the other end of the galaxy is blue. Does that mean that they have received information faster than the speed of light? And the answer is no, because they actually already had the information subluminally, because they learned about it before they even left Earth. They haven't gained anything new here, and that there is no way to actually communicate real information using this method.
Right.
All you can do is draw conclusions.
Yeah.
So there's this barrier. It's an interesting phenomenon, I should say, and it would be really cool to learn more about it, but it does not look like there's any way to harness it to actually communicate any information.
Right.
Right. It's not like a Morse code kind of thing where you can.
Right.
Mm-hmm. No, you can look at a photon to learn a fact, but you can't send information.
Right. For one thing, you cannot even manipulate those quanta to do what you want. What's happening is the quanta are in an unknown state.
Right.
And then you observe it. You learn the state, but at the same time, that breaks down that entanglement.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't manipulate the state of the quanta. I mean, you can manipulate the state like crazy if you're a politician.
I mean, essentially what you're saying is that the problem with quantum entanglement is you may be able to know things across a great distance really fast, even faster than light, but all you can do is just know a random outcome far away.
And you can't know everything either.
Yeah.
So that's the other thing, is that you're
you
learning.
You basically know that it's changed.
Yeah, you can
it's,
know
it's
a random
outcome. Right.
You know a random outcome, but you can't get messages back and forth.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's not communication. Right. Maybe someday we'll learn some way of harnessing that, but it looks like it's a fundamental element of the universe. It's something that is just beyond our ability to manipulate.
Can I tell y'all, I'm really excited about all the email we're going to get about how we're totally misunderstanding this.
Well, I'll be sure to forward it to you. Actually, you're on that list, so you'll be able to see it yourself. Let's move on to quantum tunneling.
Excellent. Quantum tunneling.
So quantum tunneling. Have you heard about
this? Is that what quantum dwarves do?
No.
Is that what those quantum the quantum worms from Tremors, you know?
Oh, I know what you're talking about, but those were not quantum.
No?
No, they were on far too great a scale to be on the quantum scale.
Well, okay, just tell me about your boring quantum tunneling.
I sure will. So, all right. Now, when you get down to really super, super, super tiny scales, like the nanoscale, all right, or the atomic scale, that's even better. So you get to the atomic scale. Let's say you've got an electron traveling down a pathway. You don't really know exactly where the position of that electron is at any given moment. You really can just create sort of a sphere around the potential places where that electron could be given its momentum. So you don't really know exactly where that electron is.
Okay.
Is my point. All right.
Sure.
So that sphere is a certain size.
But you have like a probability.
A probability. Right. Yeah. There's a probability that it could be on any point in that sphere.
Mm-hmm.
Now that sphere is approaching an electronic gate, a transistor. So this is something that we'd see in a microprocessor. And in fact, quantum tunneling is something that microprocessor manufacturers have to actually worry about.
Wow.
So it gets towards this gate. The gate is closed, which means that the electron should not pass through it.
Mm-hmm.
But if the gate is thin enough, so we're talking about a microprocessor that's got very, very, very tiny connections in order to pack as many transistors in there as possible. If the gate is thin enough, then that field where the electron possibly could be could overlap that gate and actually pass on to the other side.
Oh.
And because the probability is there that the electron might be on the other side, sometimes it is on the other side. So it's as if it has passed through the gate without actually passing through it. On one moment it's on one side, on the next moment it's on the other side. Now with microprocessors, this is a problem because if the gate is supposed to be closed and blocking off the electrons,
mm-hmm.
and the electrons are passing through anyway,
then we don't want Schrödinger's electron to be on the other side.
Yeah, you get computer errors.
Yeah,
you know, it's just not working properly because it cannot control the flow of electrons the way it needs to in order to run processes.
Wow.
So this is a real problem when it comes to microarchitecture.
This gets into a thing about matter, right? That solid matter isn't really solid. Right,
there's more empty space.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's all that as well. But that's slightly different, but an interesting idea. So the part about quantum tunneling that gets to faster than light communication is that it appears that the electron can pass over a distance faster than a photon would be able to travel that same distance. So,
what?
You know, this jump where it would go from one side of a gate to another side of a gate, it could do that at a speed that's faster than the speed of light.
How is that possible? Because an electron has mass.
See, that's a good question. And honestly, the answer is really more like it's probably another manifestation of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, where to us it appears as if the electron is moving faster than the speed of light, when in reality it's not.
But it's really just a probability issue more so than a... Yeah.
Right. It's more of a probability thing than an actual speed thing. But then, you know, there are those who have said that if you calculate it at these incredibly tiny distances, remember, we're talking the nanoscale here. So
very small stopwatch.
A nanometer is 1/1,000,000th of a meter. So we're talking really, really tiny. At that scale, it's essentially that electron might move at what would be equivalent to 4.7 times the speed of light. But again, it's all this probability uncertainty stuff. It may not have anything to do with speed at all. It has to do with our understanding of quantum mechanics.
Well, yeah, I mean, it would have to, right? Because that would posit, like we talked about earlier, that the electron would have to have infinite mass and infinite energy, right?
Right.
So
obviously that's not happening.
And again, most physicists are saying that there's, even with this interesting phenomenon, there's no capacity here for faster than light communication. So, you know, we've been shooting down these things left and right. I think ultimately what the conclusion we come to is, as we understand the world to operate as of right now, there is no faster than light communication opportunity out there. That's not to say that we won't find it later down the line. and that some discovery won't allow us to have this what to us right now really does seem a magical property.
Yeah. Well, it does seem impossible based on what we know, but I think we should point out that almost every really, really cool innovation has come by people trying to do things that were said to be impossible.
Right. Sure. Yeah. And who knows what we'll know tomorrow?
Yeah.
Who knows what we'll know by the time this podcast goes live?
Yeah.
We'll get more of those emails.
Right.
Excellent.
And if we're lucky, maybe we already received them because they were sent faster than light and they've traveled back in time to when,
right.
before we
sent
if
by the,
only they had gotten here just before we recorded, we could have prevented all that.
The Tachyon anti-email server.
Yeah. I think I've got my spam filter blocking all Tachyon messages, so.
It's for the best.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's a good discussion on faster than light communication.
Enlarge
folks.
Your tachyons.
Yeah, we're going to wrap this sucker up. So, guys, if you have any suggestions on topics we should tackle in future episodes of Forward Thinking, get in touch with us. Let us know. We've got an email address. That's fwthinking@discovery.com. Or drop us a line on our website. That's fwthinking.com. You can read our blogs there. You can watch the video series. You can listen to more episodes of the podcast. You can join us on our social media. And you can tell us how we all need to go attend a quantum mechanics lecture to make sure that we know what we're talking about. I'm fairly confident, but then I'm also tired. But we will all talk to you again, maybe in the past.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.